This is Bob Morris. In today's desert horticulture, why are people turning to the internet for answers to their problems and then disappointed when these answers don't pan out? All this and more on today's desert horticulture. I think all of you know what I'm talking about, or at least have experienced it. You'll give the best information you can, and you're even careful about saying whether it comes from research or not. But then when you give that advice to someone, they will check your sources of information with information they find on the internet. That information may be good, it may not be very good, but it's available. And if it fits into their agenda, fits into their program, they'll use it and disregard the information that you gave them. Checking the information that I provided doesn't offend me in any way. It's a good practice. It's something you should be doing. But in saying that, I hope that people who do check the information do compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges. Because I was told one time by a nursery owner that the consumers generally, there was a product that I hoped would make it to the market. And this nursery owner told me one time, he said, put it in a good package because people will buy it. In other words, it didn't matter if the product was any good or not. What mattered more to the people is whether it's in a good package. I guess we can say that about anything, whether it's ourselves or whatever we have. We put our best foot forward. We want people to get over that hurdle. But we worry a little bit when we present information that's solid, that we think is solid, and people will double-check it and go with something that is not as solid simply because it has a better package. I'm reminded of a circumstance, and I have to be a little bit careful here because I don't want to reveal names, but I was consulting one time to an individual, and this individual was producing a product that was very high class, but they had never done it before, and I had never done it before. They had told me they searched the internet, and they said that this product would last indefinitely if it was stored under certain conditions. And I, in the back of my head, I was questioning whether anything fresh could be stored for an indefinite length of time, for a very long period of time, and still maintain its quality. But this person told me, yes, they had searched the internet and they believed it and they had tried it. So I went ahead and I brought someone who is more knowledgeable about this subject than me, and because I wanted a benchmark. I wanted someone to examine the same thing when this person wasn't there. And I went in and got some of that product, and I presented it to that, and that person said, no, it's no good. In fact, it was starting within 3 weeks after it was harvested, this product was already turning bad. And this individual said they could smell it. They could smell the problems. So it wasn't something that this person ended up, I'm guessing, probably losing most of this product because it went bad in a much shorter period of time than this person originally thought, because they listened to something, some advice given on the internet, and either that advice was good or it was bad. I don't know, because I don't know what information was being listened to, But that information in this particular instance was not appropriate. When I looked at the product, and I looked at the moisture level just from a, without any tools or instruments, I just looked at what the moisture level would be, and I thought, you know, there's no way that this product can stay fresh as long as this person thinks it is, regardless of what they listened to on the internet. So again, you don't know what that person or how that in-person interpreted, or even if they were being told the truth or not. So you end up disregarding it. I worry a little bit about the packaging that goes on when a product is being delivered. I worry a little bit about the information. I worry a little bit about how that information is received and how it's tweaked, how that person may be fitted into the agenda they already had. Maybe they already had harvested this product and they needed to keep it longer. And this person says you can keep it as long as you want to, which makes you wonder a little bit about this information and where people are getting it. I guess if it were me and I were looking at trying to find an answer to a problem, I would look at three things. I would look at the packaging. In other words, how is it being presented? And is it being sponsored by someone? Because the stuff that's appearing on the internet right now is getting better and better. The packaging, as I call it, the marketing aspect, is improving a lot. So that means that they already know, whoever is presenting the information, already knows that packaging and how it's presented is very important. Secondly, the second thing I would look for is the source of that information. So if the packaging, for instance, is done by a company that has a vested interest in what you're trying to do, be careful. Be careful. The source of information, we have extension services in this country, in the United States, that is supposed to be free of bribes and of innuendos and everything else. We're supposed to be. Of those in this country, the University of California and to a lesser degree, the Arizona State University and the University of Arizona are really good places to start looking for information applicable to our desert environment. Notice that I come out of the University of Nevada. It doesn't receive a lot of monetary assistance in that regard. It doesn't put a lot of emphasis into those programs. So I have a tendency. Plus, the state of Nevada is divided into a cold region and the southern part where Las Vegas is located, in the hot desert regions of that country. So when I'm looking for something, I'm looking for how trustworthy is that information, and I'm tweaking it towards other desert areas, such as Arizona, and to a lesser degree, West Texas and New Mexico. Although there's some very good information out of New Mexico and West Texas. But again, if you're in a desert environment, then focus on those desert and arid environments. Don't rely on stuff out of Cornell, for instance, or Florida. Although there's good information that comes out of Florida and Cornell and Texas A&M and other wetter parts of the country, but just be careful when you look at that. So, first of all, is the packaging, is how it's being presented. The second part of it I already covered, and it's the source of the information. And thirdly, is its applicability. Do you have a current problem and you're trying to find a solution for it? Be careful, because there are solutions out there. Some of them are good, some of them are bad. Just be very, very careful which ones you pick up. And pick something that may or may not fit into your agenda. If your agenda is looking for something, an answer to a problem, well, you're going to find it on the internet, because you're going to Google, you're going to search for those keywords that will answer the question that you're presenting it. So if you're presenting a question, be very, very careful. So those three things I would be very careful about: the packaging, the source of the information, and its applicability, its usability. Be very careful for those reasons. I've talked a little bit about in a general sense about searching on the internet, and I really was more or less looking at those instances when we're looking for science answers, and maybe possibly no science answers, but in a real general sense, what we're really concerned about here is desert horticulture, is the applicability of this towards agriculture. And for that reason, I look at five things that are very important regarding agriculture in desert regions versus non-desert regions. And the first one can be the soil type. I'm reminded of, I moved to the eastern Mojave Desert area from another location that was arid, but not quite desert. And prior to that, I was in the Midwest, upper Midwest, where it's rainy and where it's overcast and whatnot. So my progression has been from these Midwestern rainier locations to arid, to more arid, to finally desert. So I wanted to talk about the applicability of these five things that are important in desert horticulture. One is the soils. Second, and I'll cover them now, the soils itself. Secondly is the intensity of the sunlight, the possibility of wind, especially drying winds, and temperature and humidity. Those things are most important factors that can be a little bit different than they are in other places, and they can be measured. You can use an app, for instance, and find the weather for a certain area. And it's important, if you don't have an app that does weather, it's important to download it and put it on your phone and check it periodically. But anyway, regardless of that, that's another topic. So first of all, I wanted to talk about the soils, desert soils in particular. And they range anywhere from first of all, soils have a chemical component and they have a structural component. Those two things. What I'm mostly talking about right now is the structural component of a soil, how it's put together, the air spaces, the preponderance of air spaces in a soil. We can affect that, and we can affect the nutrient content to some degree by the type of amendments that we add to soil. So are amendments necessary? Sometimes it just depends on the plants that you're using. I got a question the other day about some flowers. Well, they're flowers, annual flowers. These are flowers that have to be replaced every marigolds, snaps, and petunias in a seed mix, and why they weren't doing so well in a particular soil. Regardless of that, it's the time of the short answer is it's the time of year and the amount of amendments in the soil. So in other words, when you have a plant and you're putting it into a soil, there are soils that just don't need any amendment at all. And then there are soils that need a lot of amendment. I also have some property in a tropical area that I've maintained over the last 15 years. And it's been a real source, because I've told people, if you want to measure the organic content of a soil, look at its color. Well, I grit my teeth a little bit, because where I'm from, in a tropical area, the soil is really black. It's a black color in soil. It's not a organic, it's not a lava soil, it's not organic soil, but the organic content is fairly low. I wouldn't say. It has to be amended for things like vegetables. And that gets us to another point, too. The structure of the soil itself has to be amended for whatever plant you're growing. For instance, on trees and shrubs, which we're going to talk about some research that addresses this a little bit, for trees and shrubs, you only need about 2% organics in the soil, and the soil is fine. You don't get any benefit at all from increasing the organic content of a soil. You don't benefit the structure of that soil at all by adding more amendments plus beyond 2%. Now, that may not be true of its nutrition, but as far as its structural component, as far as its structure goes, that's all you need. 2% for trees and shrubs. That includes fruit trees, it includes landscape trees, it includes shrubs, it includes fruit shrubs, it includes shrubs that you're going to grow for whatever purpose that you've got. So, but if we're going to grow vegetables and flowering annuals, then the organic content needs to be a little bit higher than 2%. Well, how do you measure that? Well, what I used to tell people, and I tell people now used to tell people to look at the color of the soil, because when we're getting to temperate soils, the soils found in the United States and most of the temperate regions of the world, if you lack organic content, the soil becomes lighter and lighter. I like to compare it. Well, how light is light? So a soil, for instance, that has the color of a light tan color, or a coffee that has been added way too much cream in it, then the soil content, the organic matter content, is probably 1% or less. And a lot of that can be told by how you're digging in the soil. If you add organic content to a soil, it's easier to dig. If you have to use a pick on it, as long as it's diggable, and moistured in order to loosen it up for the picks to even penetrate the soil, well, then the organic content is very, very low. But we can use color to judge that. If we want to get up into the 2% range, then the color is more like a rich coffee color with a little bit of cream in it. It's not tan anymore. It's more brownish in color. If we want to grow flowers and vegetables in it, then it's got to be a really dark soil, like a chestnut color, like pure coffee, if we can get it to that color. Coffee without any creamer in it at all. So the color of a soil has a lot to do with its organic content. Not true of some of the tropical soils, as I've discovered. Our soil, for instance, is a black soil, but that's a rarity. It's a black soil without any organic additions to it. It's normally black. That's because the minerals that were used to make that soil in the very beginning were black in color. And oftentimes that's lava. It's not in Hawaii, it's in the Philippines. But it can be black in color simply because of the source of the minerals that made that soil were dark in color to begin with. With the source of the minerals in most of our temperate soils are lighter in color, basaltic type of materials that break down, that make sand, silt and clay, the particles that make up soil. So organic content, what I'm trying to leave you with is organic content can be estimated. You can send it to a laboratory, spend $75 and wait a week for your return, 2 weeks actually, before it's returned to you with the results, and it'll precisely tell you the organic content. If you ask for that to be part of your analysis, it will tell you. But what I'm telling you is you can guesstimate the amount of organic material to a reasonable degree just by its color. You can't do that with nutrition, plant nutrition. That's got to be sent to a laboratory. And how often, that's another topic for another day. But regardless of that, what you're trying to do right now is establish the structure of that soil. So its digability, how easily does a garden trowel enter that soil? And digability has to do with if a soil has a low organic content, like for trees and shrubs, 2% or less. If it's about 2%, most trees and shrubs will handle it just fine. Lawns can be established at 2% without any trouble at all. But when you get into some of the desert soils, less than 1% in some of our soils in the eastern Mojave Desert are even less than that, are less than 1% organic matter. That's very light tan color. That's a sandy color to begin with, a basaltic color, a rock color to begin with. Okay, so we're looking at two components, the structure as well as the chemical. Chemical is to be done by laboratory. The structural you can estimate or guesstimate with visually on the structure. So for 2% organic material, most of the trees and shrubs in a landscape are fine. You don't need as much with it. But when you start getting into vegetables and flowering annuals, you need a lot more organic material than 2%. You'll need a closer to 6 or 8% organic material in it. Probably to begin with, probably at least 4%, if not 6% for most vegetables. What's probably more important is that it is sand-based, that the soil has few rocks in it, because we grow root crops, carrots and things that require, and asparagus. Considering it's, although it's an above-ground plant, we're harvesting it. It has to come up through that soil, and we'll have broken or crooked spears if we're not careful about the rock. We can have forked roots if we're in carrots if we're not careful with the sand base. So that's why I like to recommend soils that are sand-based soils that have a certain amount of compost in it. Remember, 2% organic material, all right? Trees and shrubs, for the most part. Organic material, so we've got that in soils, okay? We've got a chemical component, we've got a structural component, all right? Chemical component you send to a laboratory. How often? See my other podcast on that. Or visit my blog, Extreme Horticulture of the Desert, and see that information if you don't know. But you don't need to do it every year if you're a homeowner. You do have to do it every year if you are in the business of farming. Yes, if you're in the business of farming, those kinds of costs are important to you. But when you're a homeowner, those costs are less important. So you don't have to send it in as often, because really what we're sending it in, and the reason we want a laboratory test, a result sent back to us on the mineral content of that soil, on the plant nutrition, is so we know what we can add to that soil minerally, as a mineral product, as a fertilizer product, or a non-fertilizer product, organic product, whatever you want to add to that soil. What do we need to add to that soil in order to get it up to par, in order to grow the kinds of things? And we don't want to excessively add stuff to that soil, because that costs us money, doesn't it? To haul it, to put it on the soil, to buy it, if we have to buy it, manufacturing it, there's a cost associated with all of those inputs, agricultural inputs, and farmers need to know those costs. They're primarily business people. They need to make money when they're done at the end of the day to put food on the table for their families, okay? So the second part of this equation that I'm talking about is solar radiation. And that's what's different about and I tried to find sources of that told me how much more solar radiation there is in the desert versus the non-desert areas. But there's a considerable amount more, and I'm guesstimating it could be as high as 10 to 20% higher than in other. In other words, the intensity of the sunlight is much more intense in desert regions than they are in non-desert regions that have some cloud cover, occasional cloud cover, and have moisture in the air to affect the light intensity that's being shown on a certain area. So solar radiation is important. This is driven home when we're trying to establish orchards. Whenever we're doing whatever plant we're trying to establish, we want to shade that trunk as much as possible to prevent that solar radiation from, and the interior part of the tree, we want to shade it, and the fruit that's being produced. If we're producing fruit, and if it's a fruit tree, what do we want to do? Bottle trees, for instance, in the desert, they're very susceptible. They're thin-skinned, they're thin-barked. They're very susceptible to burning on the upper parts of the branches if we don't have a solid crown. And so we're going to see, anyway, regardless of that, solar radiation can be important aspect of this. After solar radiation, there's wind. And there are other places, Chicago, for instance, it's off the lake. But the difference is the wind carries a lot more water in it. It's a lot more moist than the wind from desert and arid regions. They're much drier. They move much more quickly. They can move with a lot less effort. When we have water coming off the lake, like in the Chicago area, or in the lakes area around Ohio and New York, when the wind comes off of those lakes, it's full of water. Whether it's frozen or not, it's full of water. It's higher in humidity. It's harder to push. And so that wind also, when it hits something, is going to be heavier. It's going to push harder when it hits something. It's harder to push, but it's also harder to stop. So in the desert regions, wind can be an important factor because of its humidity content. In particular, and its movement and how much destruction it can do. Thirdly is the temperature. In temperature, we give temperature a lot more credit than it deserves. Temperature can be very important to plants, and that's why that and light intensity, solar radiation, is why we plant on certain sides of a building. And it's better to plant, for instance, on vegetable gardens do better if they get some shade from the late afternoon sun. So vegetable gardens, for instance, and other plants too, the privets, for instance, will do much better. Anything coming out of China and Japan will do, in the Carolinas, will do a lot better if it doesn't have to face that west or southerly exposure of sunlight and wind and temperature radiating off of walls. We have different, what we call microclimates, that exist inside of landscapes. For that reason, the temperature, humidity, the wind, all of those things play important factors. The last one that's important in desert situations is the humidity. And in the eastern Mojave Desert, where I'm located, our humidity content can be 10% or less. On a really humid day, we may hit 30, 40% humidity. That's a lot different. That's why we struggle, I think. We struggle sometimes. And that's why research has a hard time corroborating that. But I think we struggle sometimes. It's been with our humidity and fruit set and flowering set. And it's because of the humidity content, the moisture in the air. With higher humidity, usually above 20%, flower set, fruit set is much better, is much more prolific than under 20%. That's why the 20% rule on humidity, whether it's in a tropical area or a temperate area like ours, is so important. That 20% rule can be very important to fruit trees. It's very hard to establish that in a laboratory or greenhouse setting, because where do you find air like that? Where do you find, except you do it in the desert. You have to use desert air. You have to use low humidity air. When they're talking about low humidity in research articles, they're not talking about less than 20% humidity, they're talking about 30 or 40%, which is fine for most plants. They fruit set just booms at 30 to 40% humidity. Yeah, of course, it'll like it much better if it's higher, but at 30, 40% humidity, flower set occurs normally. How do you get that in the desert? How do you get anything that's above 20%? It's a rarity. It's after a rain. It's after or you create an area in your yard that's wet. Lawns, increase the humidity. Pools, anything spraying the air during flowering is going to improve fruit set if the humidity is less than 20%. Generally speaking, that's why I've had poor flower set in cherries, sour, sweet cherries, in the orchards in the eastern Mojave Desert without the presence of lawns or swimming pools that to increase the humidity content, or after a rain. If it rains or if the humidity content is higher than that, that's great. It improves fruit set. It improves fruit production. Okay? So when we're looking at those components that make quote-unquote desert horticulture, we're looking at changes in the soils, changes in the sunlight intensity, changes in the temperature, the wind, and humidity. All those factors are important in desert horticulture. And that's why I promote desert horticulture as a separate type of horticulture from other types, because people that move here move from into the desert from a wetter region of the United States say, it's so difficult to garden. That's the principles haven't changed. The scientific principles haven't changed. We're going back to the internet again. But the scientific principles haven't changed. What has changed is our understanding of those scientific principles, because we have to apply it differently. And that's why desert horticulture is so important to understand and comprehend in our areas of the country in the desert southwest region. I hear that music. It's time to go. So if you have any other questions, contact me, Bob Morris. Bye-bye. Follow me on my blog, Extreme Horticulture of the Desert. That's Extreme Horticulture starting with an X. All one word. Follow me on Facebook and Twitter.